The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Life goes on in Damascus after 14 years of rule by Bashar al-Assad came to a crashing end last weekend. With shops open and workers commuting, a sense of normality is starting to emerge. But with reports of wide-scale torture being recorded and a country still gripped by internal conflict, sustained peace for Syrians may still be a faraway dream. Joining me now on the ground in Syria, Sally Hayden, Irish Times correspondent in Damascus. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Now, first of all, normality, how normal, how routine?
Yeah, I mean, this is such a difficult question. And I feel like first I need to slightly correct something that you said in your intro. You said I'd be talking about life under the new regime, but like we don't know that there is a regime right now. Actually, what has happened is a regime, the Assad family regime that ruled this country for more than a half a century, fell in an astonishing, you know, shock moment on Sunday morning. And, you know, this is a country just coming to terms with that. So right now it's just, I wouldn't say chaos, it's extreme hope. There's like extreme happiness. If you think of what has happened before, and again, this question, like, is normality returning? Like, arguably, there hasn't been normality here in decades. You know, 600,000, an estimated 600,000 were killed in the war that lasted the last nearly 14 years. 14 million were displaced, the UN says. And what we know is that around 100,000 disappeared into prisons under the Assad family, and that now there's a desperate search to find out what has happened to those people. And so, yeah, there are people out on the streets, but I was here under the regime in 2017. The mood is completely different. People are speaking freely. They don't seem scared anymore. I mean, they're scared of uncertainty. They don't know what's coming next, but there's not that kind of air of fear that everyone you speak to, you used to feel like they were frightened that any words they said, you know, they just didn't know what would happen to them afterwards. And I was walking with a Syrian friend yesterday who said, you know, if I had been seen in the streets talking to you as a foreign journalist a few, you know, even weeks ago, I could have been locked up in prison for that.
Now, the question of the ambitions and the pious statements of al-Julani, Muhammad al-Julani, the leader, although he has reverted, I believe, to his birth name from now on, he may have issued pious statements and talked about his ambitions, but that doesn't mean that everybody who's come to witness the downfall of Damascus with the Kalashnikov in their hands is going to be as pious as he is.
Yeah, I mean, so of course, and he's, you know, HTS, which he leads, is only one part. You don't, they're the leading part of this rebel coalition who has ousted Assad. They're not the only ones. The people who have come, yeah, and even, you know, people in their own neighborhoods got involved in this when they realized that the regime was going to finally fall. There is kind of fears of a retribution, particularly because we're seeing so much imagery now coming out of the prisons. Even about 15 minutes walk away from me is Damascus Hospital, which has like more than 30 bodies in it right now that were people found dead from torture. And outside on the street, there are pictures of those, the faces of those bodies, because there are so many families now coming to try and find out what happened to their loved ones. And so yesterday there were crowds all looking at those bodies, you know, the faces, some of them are very, very badly damaged, and they're trying to see if it's their loved ones, and they're going into the morgue to look at them themselves to try and figure that out. And I think, of course, you know, the joy that came on the first few days, it will turn with some people to anger because they're not going to get the answers that they want. But it does seem like the, you know, the rebels who have taken over, they are trying to say, you know, we want judicial processes. They've given an amnesty for soldiers generally, but people who were involved in torture, they say that they want justice against those people. But yeah, in terms of whether that will be violent justice, I'm sure there will be some of that. But I think that the actual leadership is not advocating for that.
Now, presumably there is no policing of the streets at the moment at all. So people have been free to go inside the prisons now with the doors flung open and see the instruments of torture for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what you mean exactly by policing of the streets. Like, there are HTS people around and rebels around, and they are, from what I know, encouraging the police actually to come back to work. They're kind of encouraging the civil servants to get back and the institutions to keep running. And at the same stage, yeah, people have been flocking to the prisons, and particularly people who are missing loved ones. And I was in Sednaya on Monday, which is, you know, the most notorious prison. Thousands are said to have been killed there. And there were families everywhere. Like, I spoke to somebody who had been missing her 16-year-old son for more than a decade. And she pulled out a picture of him, and she was saying, you know, she was just searching to find any clue of what happened to him. Someone else was missing their mother, someone missing a sister, and they were just searching around and yeah, hoping. Particularly, there was kind of rumors going around that there were hidden cells, that maybe they were underground. And so you saw people with shovels digging, people were knocking down walls. You know, they were very, very desperate to try and find any place that hadn't been discovered yet, and to try and find any evidence again of what had happened to the people that they had lost.
Now, I'm not sure how much freedom of movement there is, but presumably those who feel they might be targets of whatever government emerges have been fleeing. And of course, if you run, people will presume that you're guilty.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. So what I've heard is that a lot of the Alawites have cleared out of Damascus, and Alawites, obviously Bashar al-Assad was an Alawite, and they make up about 10% of Syria's population. And I believe that a large number of them have left. I know that Christians were quite anxious, some of them. And so I heard reports that people were staying in their houses for a while. But the government, or the, you know, whatever you want to call them, their rebel leaders have said that they will respect minorities. And they've made various statements to that regard. And I think more people are emerging. But of course, you know, if you were associated with the previous regime, that may be a different story. And I did hear even yesterday, like when I crossed on Monday, there were some people trying to cross into Lebanon because I crossed the other way. But I heard yesterday there were thousands who had gone to the border there to try and cross. And others, I think, have gone to Latakia, which is obviously was a regime stronghold.
Now, the question of the Russians, and they are seen as big losers in the geopolitical battles that go on. But there's some talk of the Russians trying to encourage the Alawites to set up their own state, which would, of course, include the Russian facilities as well within the borders of that state. That's clearly where the Russians felt most comfortable. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I think that so much has just been up in the air. There are so many factors at play here right now. And what we know is that the Russians obviously didn't support Assad enough to actually, you know, maintain, like they were very key in helping him maintain control in 2015, 2016, when it looked like he might be ousted before. Whereas this time they're obviously distracted in Ukraine, and they didn't do that when it looked like he would be ousted this time. And I think their decision not to do that was probably pretty key. But as to what role they'll play in the future, that's not clear. We know that Assad is obviously in Russia now. Another factor, again, that's like really important, but, you know, there's just so much happening that it's probably not even getting the attention it should, is what Israel is doing. In 2 days, Israel struck nearly 500 targets across Syria. Like my first night here, we couldn't sleep because there were constant Israeli airstrikes nearby. And they say that they're hitting military targets because they don't trust whoever the next administration will be to have control over them. And, you know, even this morning, I can hear booms in the distance. I don't know if that's Israeli airstrikes or not, but potentially it is.
Yeah, the Israelis are claiming they're hitting weapons dumps to avoid the arms falling into the hands of the wrong people, people who would use them against Israel. And also they claim they have targeted chemical weapons facilities which had been used by the regime.
Yeah, and actually a Syrian friend said, like, because we both came from Lebanon, where we've obviously been under war for the last few months with Israel as well, you know, reporting on that. And my friend who's Syrian said, like, that's the one good thing in his opinion that they did do, because it meant that Assad couldn't use those against his own people before he was ousted. Certainly on Monday, when I was in Sednaya prison, like the families, like I said, were desperately searching for information about loved ones, but Israeli airstrikes were going off quite nearby. And, you know, that wasn't deterring anyone from their searches. But I would say one definitely hit a weapons depot, because after it struck, we could see kind of, you know, ongoing explosions. Like the sky started glowing orange, you know, in kind of like popping noises. Mm-hmm. Like, so you can tell that it's something that's obviously been hit that's then continuing to go off.
Now, what about the extended Syrian diaspora? So many people fled to neighboring countries, but also to Western Europe. What are the prospects that this general class of people will say, we're going back? We have an opportunity now to build the new Syria.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, you have two classifications of those people. So one thing you have to be really conscious of is that Syrians have been through huge trauma, like unimaginable trauma, both the people who left and the people who stayed. And for many people going back, it's going to be like coming to terms with a lot of what they've gone through, and also the fact that there's ongoing insecurity and they don't know where things will go. So re-entering that is very, very difficult. The people that I've spoken to who are thinking of coming back tend to be the ones who have already European passports because they've been in Europe long enough, which means that they can come back, try and play a role maybe in rebuilding the country, but also they could leave again if things get very bad. I've also heard from people who are, you know, for example, one family in Lebanon who were selected for Irish refugee resettlement, and they are really now concerned that they won't be taken there anymore and they won't be able to travel to Ireland. And they say, you know, it's a family with young children. They say, this is a chaotic situation. You know, it's an unstable. I can't bring my children back there. And again, they're highly traumatized by what they've already been through. So for the parents as well, it's very difficult to return to this environment. And of course, seeing things like what's coming out of Sednaya, that's, you know, it's not just a reminder of the past, but it's also kind of, I don't want to say a warning for the future, because hopefully this will never happen again. But it's just kind of, you know, it's terrifying for people to be faced with that and to know the cruelty of humans, basically.
And Sally, how difficult is it to get information from the regime? I mean, I presume before in Damascus, there were government statements, a government press office and so on, and they would spin the stories that the Assad regime wanted spun. What's the way of getting information from the rebels?
Yeah, I mean, it's totally different. So actually, before, foreign media was extremely controlled. I actually came here once, 2017, and I could not have come back under the Assad regime because I wrote something about torture in prisons, like I did an investigation. And so I even never imagined that I'd be able to come back to Syria. So to come here as a foreign journalist is like extremely impossible unless you were very particularly like considered to be pro-regime before. Whereas now, you know, you can walk around and just talk to rebels on the streets. Yesterday, I interviewed one in the city center. From what I know, they're taking very seriously their efforts to try and make sure that the country will continue to operate and that it can become successful. The new prime minister had held a meeting on Tuesday with all the heads of Syria's government departments, the former heads, to see how to arrange a transfer of power. And they let the Financial Times sit in on that. And there's a good piece from them kind of explaining what happened in that meeting, which exposed like a lot of corruption and ineffectiveness. And yeah, they seem to be very open right now. Even the fact that there's foreign journalists everywhere, as you can imagine. And we came in when there weren't checks on the border, but we haven't had any issues going around the place.
Sally Hayden, Irish Times correspondent in Damascus. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.